Superpowers in the headlines today, Russia.
Russia has invaded a sovereign neighboring state and threatens a democratic government elected by its people. Such an action is unacceptable in the 21st century.
On a much lighter note, at the Beijing Olympics, China, perhaps a changing of the guard.
Just about official, there's a new China syndrome, and it's called China Gold.
Today, military might and physical prowess. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, August 12th. I'm Catherine Lanfer in for John Hockenberry. Hey, good morning, Adora.
Good morning, Catherine.
Now, this morning, broken records and hearts at the Olympics, a basketball team that goes from dream to redeem, and the death of a political force of nature in Cleveland, plus political pressure in Pakistan and diplomatic pressure in Russia. That's all coming up this hour. But first, these headlines.
Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has called for a halt to military action in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. In a nationally televised speech, the president ordered the Russian military to defend itself and stamp out armed Georgian resistance. But he said Georgia had been punished enough. Yesterday, President Bush called on Russia to accept a formal ceasefire.
The Georgian government has accepted the elements of a peace agreement that the Russian government previously said it would be willing to accept.
The Russian announcement comes as French President Nicolas Sarkozy heads to Moscow to mediate. A roadside bomb hit a Pakistan Air Force truck on the outskirts of the northern city of Peshawar, killing as many as 14 people. Pakistani officials say al-Qaeda-linked militants are probably behind the attack. Pakistan recently stepped up military operations in the region.
It's gold again for U.S. swimmer Michael Phelps. This time in the 200-meter freestyle, it was his third gold medal, bringing him closer to his goal of winning 8 at the Beijing Games. Mexican authorities have established an anti-kidnapping squad in response to growing concern about the kidnap and murder of a prominent businessman's son. The squad will consist of 300 officers spread throughout Mexico. There have been thousands of kidnappings in Mexico in recent years.
Oil prices have dropped to their lowest level in 3 months, trading at about $114 a barrel in Asian trading this morning. The drop is attributed to a stronger dollar combined with lower demand from China.
In politics, John McCain's in Pennsylvania today before heading to New Jersey for a fundraiser, and Barack Obama's on vacation. But his campaign has announced that he'll reveal his pick for vice president via text message and email the minute he makes his decision. The Dow closed up just under a 0.5% at 11,782. The S&P jumped a little over 0.5%, and it opens at 1305.
And today we're remembering Fannie M. Lewis, a political force in the city of Cleveland, and she was actively urging people to vote and to make sure that the voting system is fair. We want to know, who has inspired you to take action? What words, what sentiments, what have they done that has inspired you to do something? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're talking about people who inspire.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning on this Tuesday, August 12th. Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry, who's away. This morning we have some new developments on the crisis between Russia and the Republic of Georgia. Today, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev ordered a halt to military action in Georgia, saying it had punished Georgia enough and restored security for civilians and Russian peacekeepers in the breakaway South Ossetia region. But the signals are mixed. Russian forces are still authorized to fire on enemy companies in the region, and Russia is making what some call belligerent demands. The foreign minister says Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili should step down and that Georgia should leave South Ossetia for good. Stephen Eek is the Russian affairs analyst for our partner, the BBC World Service, and he joins us now. Thanks for being with us, Stephen.
You're more than welcome. So, very interesting day we have now, the fifth day of this conflict between Russia and Georgia over the breakaway regions of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. Let's not forget there are two of them. But an interesting day diplomatically, given that the French leader, Nicolas Sarkozy, is in Moscow. He's talking to President Dmitry Medvedev of Russia and appears to have been part of this process that's led to Mr. Medvedev saying Russia is actually going to stop the active part of its military operations, although it is going to leave its armed forces very much in South Ossetia and Abkhazia. At the same time, slightly later on today, we have the leaders of five former communist countries, now quite anti-Russian countries in Eastern Europe, Poland, Ukraine, Lithuania, Latvia and Estonia, off to see President Saakashvili in Tbilisi in Georgia. His position now looks quite confused if you think about it in a wider perspective. Russia has said it isn't going to move to try to remove him. It doesn't want to do regime change, but it would be rather better for everyone were he to actually step down. Mr. Saakashvili, I'm more than certain, has no intention of doing that whatsoever. And so we have these five Eastern European heads of state heading off to Georgia to give him moral support.
Stephen, what do you make of the fact that the Russian foreign minister, right before the Russian president said they would halt action in Georgia, the foreign minister called for the Georgian president to step down? They came very close together in timing. What to make of that?
Well, it's quite easy to read signals. You know, are there any kind of differences between the foreign policy people in Moscow and the president and his campaign himself? The one thing we can say with 100% certainty is that the person running this whole show from the Russian perspective appears to have been Vladimir Putin, the former president and now, of course, the prime minister, who has very close links with the Russian security apparatus, with the Russian military, and has been the person really all over the Russian response and in control of the Russian operation to events in South Ossetia. The Georgians, I'm more than certain, listening to their diplomats and their representatives here in Europe, really didn't expect such a harsh response from the Russians, and they still insist they were right in launching the operation to retake South Ossetia on Thursday evening last week. But the situation we have now is that Russia is in full control of those two separatist regions of Georgia and has actually created a kind of sanitary cordon around them by mounting a certain limited incursion into Georgian territory itself. And Russia, of course, as we've now heard, has no intention of leaving.
And Stephen, these tensions have been simmering for decades, if not centuries, in one form of another. It seems the world community was quite stunned by Russia's actions and quite alarmed at the quickness and the directness with which they moved straight into the breakaway republics and then threatened the Republic of Georgia. Should they have been?
Well, the tensions between Georgia and Russia have been mounting for a long time now, and especially since the Rose Revolution at the end of 2003 that brought Mikhail Saakashvili to power, pro-Western leader who stated that his ultimate aim is to have Georgia join NATO and the European Union. Russia said all along it would not allow that to happen. It would use all the means at its disposal to stop that, to prevent it. Maybe the West does have a certain case to answer in not taking that seriously enough. It's been obvious over the last 3 or 4 months that Russia has been building up its armed forces on the Russian side of the border with Georgia, an ominous signal that perhaps we didn't pay enough attention to. But there is, of course, now a very serious situation because we have a sort of three-way crisis of relations between Russia and Georgia, between the separatist regions of Georgia and Georgia, and between Russia and the West. A very, very serious mess.
Stephen, very quickly, what are you going to be watching for today?
I'm going to be watching to see what happens in Abkhazia, which is a much more prized potential possession for Georgia and the Russians than South Ossetia, and also watching to see whether fighting on the ground calms down, because in the South Caucasus, these things very often acquire their own logic and become quite unstoppable.
Stephen Eek, thank you.
Thank you.
Stephen Eek is a BBC Russian affairs analyst, and he came to us from London. Catherine?
Thanks, Adora. We're going to go now to former Ambassador James Collins. He was a former ambassador to Russia during the Clinton administration for the first year of the Bush administration. He's joining us by phone from Maryland. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Catherine.
Now, you were our man in Moscow, given that you were keeping track of what's going on this morning. How effective do you think the comments by President Bush yesterday about how the Russian behavior was unacceptable, how did that push to some of the results we're seeing today?
Well, I think it's hard to attribute, any result to one or another statement, but I think certainly the toughening position that Mr. Bush articulated was listened to in Moscow. However, I think also it's very important that President Sarkozy has arrived and has with him a signed ceasefire agreement signed by the Georgian president. So the pressure certainly on Russia to halt its military operations have been mounting. And I think probably that, combined with the fact that the Russians themselves are well into Georgia and have achieved, I suppose, a substantial military success from their point of view, goes a long way to explain the new development.
Well, then, what kind of diplomatic solution is it if they're already in Georgia? Supposedly there are reports of Russian warplanes bombing the town of Gori today, and they've said that they're still authorizing their forces to fire on enemies in South Ossetia.
Well, I think the first order of diplomatic business for Mr. Sarkozy and all the rest of the international system that is involved is going to be to consolidate a ceasefire, make it real. I'm sure the second part, in one way or another, will be the terms under which they will achieve Russian withdrawal from Georgian territory. I think, however, the real difficult problem will remain that of the South Ossetia province, which is claiming it will not return to Georgian control. And there is the uncertain situation in the other breakaway province of Abkhazia, which I think Stephen just mentioned, where it's very hard to know exactly what's happening and whether or not the Abkhazians are going to see themselves as part of this ceasefire arrangement.
How does this redraw the map for Russia and its neighboring countries, so many of whom the United States has tried to welcome in the democratic fold, if you will?
Well, it seems to me that if nothing else, the Russians have made it clear that when they say that they will not find any expansion of NATO to include Georgia and Ukraine an acceptable step, this is going to be taken a lot more seriously. They have talked about using all means at their disposal. Well, this military action was a means that I think has in fact shocked a lot of the international community by its, first of all, the scale of it and the rapidity with which it took place, and also the sort of completely cynical approach to the problem of dealing with issues in one of Georgia's provinces. So I think, you know, everyone
is going... Or, Mr. Ambassador, was it a message, perhaps? What influence does the U.S. have now in dealing with Russia?
Well, I think it has no more or less influence than it did before. Military intervention has not been an option. However, the United States does, along with the rest of the European community, have a very substantial set of points of influence, from economics to trade to Russia's involvement in security systems, so forth. I mean, Russia does want to be and need to be a part of the European security system. And so I'm sure that the pressures now are going to be very substantial for Russia to put itself back in better standing by resolving this conflict with Georgia in some acceptable way.
James Collins, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you very
much.
That
is the former U.S. ambassador to Russia, James Collins. Of course, we're going to keep following this story here on The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer in for John Hockenberry. Now, when you got up this morning, we know you discovered American swimmer Michael Phelps netted another gold medal. But more than that happened while you were asleep. And for that, we go to our own Ollie Williams, staying up all night watching the Olympics for the BBC.
I have. It's coming to the end of a very long night, but it's always enjoyable. I tell you, there are boundless possibilities to the stories the Olympics throws up, and I've got another bountiful selection for you this morning.
Well, we know that a lot of records are being broken at the Olympics. How about hearts?
Well, let's talk a little bit about swimming karma, shall we? Because Michael Phelps, obviously doing very well at the moment, that means someone must be having a bad year somewhere, and that someone is French star Laure Manaudou, who it may well end up quitting the sport. She told French TV this morning she doesn't care about swimming anymore, has no desire to even get back in the pool. Things have been that bad for her. She finished last in one final, second last in another, and she's given up even trying, she says. She gives up midway through races now because she can't keep up.
She's a medalist. She was the sweetheart of La Belle France. What happened?
Well, things change, and she has had a horrible year. Because to make matters worse, the woman suddenly winning some of her events is Italy's Federica Pellegrini, is the same woman who stole Laure Manaudou's boyfriend from her last year. And that boyfriend is the same one who's allegedly been posting photos of Laure Manaudou on the web, which she'd rather not everybody got to see. So this poor girl is having a horrible year.
When you say photos she'd rather not have people see, she was doing bad strokes?
I think she was doing something very bad. Let's leave it at that, shall we?
Oh, dear.
So she's going to quit or she's going to keep swimming?
Well, I think she'll keep swimming. It's always a heat of the moment thing. You know, you come out of the pool, you've had a terrible time. I say this as though I'm an Olympic swimmer. I've been there, I've done that. I can barely cross a length. But, you know, you say things in the heat of the moment. I'm sure she'll be back in the future. You want to hear about some bikini diplomacy?
Yes.
Yeah, it's really hard to say no to that, isn't it, Adora?
That's a brilliant two-word phrase, isn't it? It's guaranteed yes every time.
Well, we certainly need diplomacy these days, so go ahead.
Well, why not in bikinis? Georgia and Russia face each other in the beach volleyball today.
Oh, well, that's rather symbolic, isn't it?
The Georgian pair, nothing is ever simple in the Olympics. The Georgian pair are actually both Brazilian and have changed their names to sound more Georgian, having been admitted onto the Georgian team, specifically for the Olympic Games.
What name changes are we talking about here?
I don't have the names in front of me. I did see them earlier. Essentially, they suddenly sound incredibly Georgian, where they used to sound very Latin American or Brazilian or South American. And I think the names may have been chosen by the Georgian state.
Huh.
After they did some work with a PR agency to get the Brazilians over in the first place, which seems a bizarre way of putting a beach volleyball team together. But if it works, it works.
Or brilliant way to put a beach volleyball team together.
Exactly. I didn't realize you could just sign people from other countries and give them names that sounded like they came from your country, and it was all okay. But it is.
And Ollie, any talk of the wider world of what's actually happening in Georgia and Russia, given the fighting?
Well, in yesterday's air pistol event, Russia's Natalie Padarina, who, ironically enough, is a soldier in the Russian army, took silver just ahead of Georgia's Nino Salukvadze, who won bronze. And they're very close friends, and they're even former teammates. And they had a hug on the medal podium to show it's possible to rise above the conflict. So I'm hoping that might be repeated in the beach volleyball today.
And a granny.
Oh, the granny. What better way to get to the Olympic badminton than to sit in the back of a two-seater bike while your grandson pedals for 1,500 miles?
That is just unbelievable, don't you think, Catherine? 1,500 miles.
Is that its own event?
I know.
It puts the road race to shame. It's Zhao Jinkui, who is the grandmother in question. She sat in the back. Her grandson pedaled hundreds and hundreds of miles from Henan province in the center of China to Beijing. Their trip, I've no idea why, by the way. I cannot for the life of me discover why they decided to go by bike. I'm sure there are trains. I could be wrong. Anyway, the trip has sparked the imagination of the Chinese public, who, as you can imagine, are rather fetched by this. And they have decided to award the pair tickets to the 110-metre finals as well, as a gesture of goodwill, which is the single biggest event of the Games, as far as many of the Chinese are concerned. So, yeah, not bad, really. Just a season badminton.
Ollie, where do you get this stuff?
I have my sources, my dear. I keep my ear close to the ground of things that are happening in Beijing. I can never divulge my sources. Other people might find these things.
We should make it clear that you're watching all of this in London.
I am watching all this in London on many, many big screens in front of me. Very, very much glued to about 9 or 10 different events at a time. And I can assure you that if a wedding ring drops in the sand at a beach volleyball event, I'm there first with a metal detector.
Now, what after you get some well-deserved rest, what are you looking forward to in the next 24 hours?
Well, I imagine the next time I wake up, the Michael Phelps Olympic Games will be upon me once again. I have barely gone 5 minutes without seeing that man's face in front of me in one respect or another. So I'll be looking forward to seeing him go. You know, I don't know if he's swimming tomorrow. Maybe I'll actually get to go 24 hours without watching Michael Phelps smiling. One last very quick story. The Chinese rower Zhang Liang failed to turn up for his own event because he forgot which heat he was in.
Oh,
can you imagine doing that? 4 years to get into the Olympics. Forgot he was in. He thought he was in heat 3. Turned out he was in heat 2. Disqualified from a second event because he didn't turn up for the first one. His Olympics is over before he got onto the course.
Ollie Williams, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and we look forward to the next time.
And you. Speak to you soon.
Again, that's Ollie Williams. He's blogging the Olympics for our partner, the BBC World Service. And we're going to turn now to one of our other favorite partners. Femi Oke is here with the news.
Good morning, partner. 28 minutes past the hour. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has called for a halt to military action in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. But the Russian president did tell his military to stamp out any resistance that may come from Georgia. French President Nicolas Sarkozy is on his way to meet Medvedev in Moscow later on today. In fact, the meeting is probably in the next couple of minutes or so. And also to broker an EU-backed truce, that's European Union truce. He will then travel to Georgia to meet with President Mikhail Saakashvili. And oil prices have dropped to their lowest rate in 3 months. Analysts say that the lower demand from China and a stronger dollar combined to push oil prices down to $114.45 a barrel. Death and taxes may be the only certainty, but not for U.S. corporations. A new congressional report says that 2/3 of U.S. corporations paid no federal income tax between 1998 and 2005. Corporations use production costs and salary expenses to justify dodging taxes. I need to take lessons there. Let's look at your domestic and your international headlines for now. Coming up, a new Barack Obama advert is out. I will show it to you. I'll play it for you in a few minutes' time. See you soon.
All right.
Thanks, Femi.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning on this Tuesday, August 12th, and today we are remembering Fannie M. Lewis, a crusader in Cleveland, Ohio, someone who inspired hundreds, if not thousands, of people in that state. We want to know who has inspired you, who has changed your life. Give us a call at 877-8, or my take, or you can drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And joining me today is Catherine Lamfer, who's sitting in for John Hockenberry. And Catherine, next up, we're going to talk Olympic basketball,
okay,
American style. Now, you probably know Team USA crushed China in their opening game before a billion, with a B, TV viewers, earning the name Redeem Team. Today, they play Angola. And there's a lot at stake in this Olympics.
Wait a minute. They're playing Angola and there's a lot at stake?
No, for the basketball team in general at this Olympics, there's a lot at stake. Not only the honor, they've got this tradition from the 1992 U.S. Dream Team that Michael Jordan led to gold in Barcelona. They haven't done so well since then. But it's not all... not just about their honor. It's also about the future of the NBA, and that sounds rather sensational. But Mitch Lawrence, an NBA columnist for the New York Daily News, is joining us now to explain. Good morning, Mitch.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Good. Now, there's no question, Mitch, that these are the best basketball players in the world, that America has, as a group, the best basketball players in the world. Why is there any question of them dominating at this Olympics?
Well, because of what happened at the last Olympics in Athens, and they came in third, which was a startling finish considering how the United States had dominated up to that point. And even in the World Championships since then, the United States has struggled. So that's why they're called the Redeem Team, because they have to redeem themselves and get America back to the top platform in the gold medal.
And why haven't they done well? Is there too many millionaire players with not enough... what is it, inspiration to take one for their country?
No, there's different theories. The makeup of the last team in Athens was probably not as good as this one, even though they were all NBA players, and that's the first time an all-NBA team had lost in an Olympics. Probably not the right mix there, probably not the right coach. They have a different coach now in Mike Krzyzewski versus Larry Brown. Sometimes it also comes down to chemistry in the team. It comes down to the style of play. International ball is a little bit different. Sometimes there's not the cohesion. And then the flip side you always have to consider now is that these teams that the United States play in the Olympics are much better than the teams we used to roll over, like the Dream Team beat Angola 116-48. Back in 92, and they're much better now. A lot of these guys who play for Argentina and Spain, they play in the NBA. Spain's got seven players, either current or former, in the NBA, and Argentina's got five players, like Manu Ginobili of the San Antonio Spurs. He stars for Argentina, and they're the defending gold medal champs. And so what you have is you have better competition. You got to remember, when the Dream Team was ripping up Barcelona and taking the world by storm, other teams, other players on other teams were coming up to these guys for autographs before the games. They were in awe of them. They're no longer in awe of the United States. They play in the NBA. A lot of international guys play in the NBA, so the quality of competition is much better.
You're talking about 42 NBA players on 10 different national teams, but let's go back to a point that you made about the different style of play. Is there a question here of nationalism versus marketeerism for the U.S. team, in that didn't the NBA help in building the main stadium there in Beijing for the Olympics?
Yes, they did. And that's the whole thing about China, is that the NBA got in there, I think, in the last 20 years, and they see it as a real big place to sell merchandise and sell jerseys, not only helping the growth of the game in China by starting leagues and stuff and building this arena that they're playing in Beijing. They've got a plan to build over the future 10, 12 more NBA-style arenas, and they want to be very involved in the Chinese leagues over there. Not expansion-wise. There's not going to be a Beijing team playing the Knicks in, you know, a February game. But just in terms of how the NBA has influenced the growth of basketball in China, because there are 300 million players in China, we're you know, that's like our population. So there's a lot at stake here for the league. The league enjoys the fact that it is in China now for the Olympics. And, yeah, they've had a big hand in building that program there.
And you were talking about different style of play, whereas many of the international teams are focused as a team as opposed to in the U.S. You have all these individual stars. Let's start with Kobe Bryant. What did he say when he got to China?
I don't know.
Well, he was asked whether he would ever play overseas, and he said apparently, or at least he's quoted as saying, if the price were right.
Yeah, well, I doubt that, guys. And the reason is that the NBA still is the best league in the world. And although there's been a little bit, there's been some movement here in the offseason where you've had some a lot of reserve, not a lot, but they're all been reserve players, guys who don't start in the NBA. They've taken the bigger money. They're getting bigger money to play in Europe than they would in the United States. And it's not a lot by Kobe, you know, Kobe's making $20 million, $25 million a year. They're going to make $1 million. Kobe Bryant, guys like that, LeBron James, they go to Europe to vacation. They don't go to Europe to play. The best league is still in the United States, believe me. And I think he's just being very diplomatic in his answers. But Kobe is a competitor, and Kobe wants to win the most important, and forget about the every 4 years of the Olympics, the most important basketball award is the Larry O'Brien Trophy, and that's given out at the NBA Finals in June. And Kobe lost there, and so he's not going to be going to Italy to play for $50 million for 1 year, because quite frankly, Kobe Bryant, with all the endorsements he makes and guys like LeBron James, you know, the big thing for them is the prize, and the prize is the NBA trophy, not
well,
the
that's
gold
be
medal
our,
as much.
That's going to be our takeaway, the prize. Mr. Lawrence, thanks so much for joining us.
That's it, guys?
Yeah, that's it.
You don't
it.
Want to talk more? You know, there's team handball.
We'll have you come back, Mitch. We'll have you come back. Mitch Lawrence, NBA All columnist right. for the New York Daily News. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks, guys.
Now we turn to Femi Oke for the latest headlines.
Poor old Mitch. I feel sorry for him. Never mind. Let's take a look at some of the big stories making your news this morning at almost 20 minutes to the hour. In a nationally televised speech, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has just ordered a halt to military action in Georgia. He says that Russia has punished Georgia enough. But this comes at the same time that Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is calling on Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili to step down. Lavrov says that Moscow won't deal with the Georgian president. European leaders are heading to the region to mediate. Mexican authorities have formed a new squad to combat the growing problem of kidnapping. The capture and killing of a prominent businessman's son prompted officials to establish a 300-strong task force. Thousands of people have been kidnapped in Mexico in recent years. And there's a new Barack Obama which releases today. A new Barack Obama advert.
I was going to say, there's a new one. Did he get cloned or something?
Well, you know, he likes to change. Uh-huh. Let's have a look at his advert and have a listen into it. It's called Embrace.
For decades, he's been Washington's biggest celebrity.
John McCain.
And as Washington embraced him, John McCain hugged right back. The lobbyists.
I think you get the general idea. Senator McCain's advert recently accused.
Is Paris Hilton in it?
No, but okay. We have Jay Leno, we have Steve Carell from Saturday Night Live, and George Bush. And it also talks about McCain as being Washington's biggest celebrity. So it's one way that the Obama camp is hitting back at the McCain camp, and so it goes on.
And so it will continue.
I can't wait to see what they come up with next. Thanks very much, Femi.
You're very welcome.
It's Tuesday, August 12th. This is The Takeaway, and I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. And Catherine, as you know, this week we marked the passing of the comedian Bernie Mac, as well as the iconic musician and actor Isaac Hayes. Today we'd also like to take a moment to mark the death of an extraordinary woman we met covering this year's presidential election, an unsung hero for thousands in Cleveland, Ohio, and we're talking about Fannie M. Lewis. And believe me, she wouldn't want me to leave out the M. She was 82 years old, we think, because she was a little coy about her age. A former welfare recipient turned city councilwoman, a force of nature who fought tirelessly for her neighborhood. 27 years she was on the front lines, especially on election day. Here she is in action on November in 2004, when it looked like Ohio was going to be critical in deciding who would be the next president, and every vote counted.
Yeah, my name is Fannie Lewis. Who am I talking to? I'm sitting here now, and we got people jammed up against the wall. We need some voting machines and some workers out here. Hello? The voting is heavy out here. We got some precincts that have already voted 150. Yeah, hi. You're talking to Fannie Lewis. How you doing? Fannie M. Lewis, Councilman Ward Leader. I need 10 more voting devices out here at Addison. The line is at least an hour and a half. And I need some more workers. I knew the voting was going to be heavy. It's like man praying for rain and don't take an umbrella.
It was raining that day, and all of it was captured by cameras for the documentary No Umbrella. In Fannie's neighborhoods, voting machines broke down, there weren't enough ballots, lines were really long, and the election bureaucracy was slow to respond. She told me the obstacles only made her work harder.
You work for people. You work for people, and you know how important it is. Some people, says, if I don't vote, I am devastated. Some people don't miss no elections. Some people don't care what they do or don't. You have a population that really cares, especially your elderly people, like my age.
who spent a lifetime wanting to vote, who had to go through the struggle of not being able to vote.
This brash, no-nonsense, get-it-done woman was born in Memphis, Tennessee. She married young and joined the Great Northern Migration to escape the Jim Crow South. She moved into a mixed neighborhood in downtown Cleveland and took a job at a local dry cleaner. Her crusading days followed the racial turmoil of the 60s that left much of her neighborhood devastated. She started as an activist and ended up on the city council. Fannie set her sights on faulty fire hydrants, cuts to public housing, speaking loudly and often breaking the council's four-minute rule. As Cleveland Public Radio reporter David Barnett put it, "I always enjoyed the way she bludgeoned her way through protocol and was a thorn in the side of council decorum. But there was always a special place in her heart for protecting and improving the voting process."
You need to do massive training out in the community. In fact, you can even do it in the schools. You can even go to the schools and train high school students how to deal with that. My grandkids know how to vote on electronic machines.
So 2008, November, rolls around, election day. You wake up. What are you going to do?
I'm going to go vote, if good Lord willing.
And then are you going to go back to some of your precincts and make sure everyone's
getting the
ballot?
I always check the precinct to see how they're doing. And where they have any problems, I do that. As the ward leader, that's my role. Yes, people have my phone number, and if they have a problem, they can call me, and I call the Board of Election.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday. It's August 12th, and we're asking you, who has inspired you to action or to understand something differently? We want to hear your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Right now, we have some headlines for you from Femi Okay. Good morning, Femi.
Hello there, Adora. 12 minutes to the hour. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev says he's ordering an end to the Russian military assault inside Georgia. He delivered a televised speech just hours ago, but the Russian leader went on to say that he's authorized his troops to crush any further resistance from Georgian forces attempting to defend the breakaway regions inside Georgian territory. He's demanding that Georgian troops pull out of those disputed areas and stop fighting. In Pakistan, a senior official says that military forces have killed a senior Al-Qaeda member in clashes near the Afghan border. News agencies describe the dead Egyptian man as third in command at the terrorist organization. A prominent Chinese Christian activist has escaped his captors and is now in hiding. The man was detained while he was on his way to a church service attended by President Bush during his Beijing visit. Police are denying any involvement in the man's disappearance. And an environmental group says the humpback whale is on the road to recovery and is no longer in immediate danger of extinction. The group says the population is up at least 60,000. Just four decades ago, the humpback whale was nearly hunted out of existence. And that's a look at your international and domestic headlines.
Thanks very much, Femi. We move now to Pakistan, where President Pervez Musharraf, who's been a key ally of the Bush administration's war on terrorism, is facing serious efforts to impeach him. Today, the second of Pakistan's four provincial assemblies passed a resolution calling for Musharraf to step down or face impeachment. Musharraf has repeatedly refused. Joining us now to talk about these latest developments is Daniel Markey, a senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations. Good morning, Daniel, and thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning.
What do you make of these efforts, these continued efforts to unseat Musharraf?
Well, this is basically a part of a long-term process, a process that's been over a year in the making, that is basically a political transition that began with the I guess, two springs ago with a Chief Justice issue, Musharraf trying to dismiss the Chief Justice, and then moved up until last winter's February elections, which included a campaign marked by the death of Benazir Bhutto, and now has moved into what may be the sort of the terminal stage for President Musharraf himself, which looks like an effort by the civilian leaders of Pakistan to finally get rid of him once and for all.
Now, there were a long list of accusations violating the Constitution for the conduct you mentioned of dismissing the judges, gross misconduct in office, economic mismanagement, and yesterday, charges of corruption seemed to almost come out of nowhere, where you had leader of the opposition party accusing Musharraf of misappropriating $700 million of American aid. What's your take on that?
Well, at this stage, I'm not convinced that this particular charge has a lot of merit to it. If there's been corruption over the past 8 years or so under Musharraf and his government, it's probably more in the form of institutional corruption. By that I mean that the military has been in charge of the government. The military has had the ability to do what it sees fit with resources from the national budget, which includes spending money on military projects that help army officers and things like that. But very little of it has to do with the direct looting of the budget by somebody like Musharraf himself. I haven't seen any evidence that really supports this particular charge. Of course, that could come out. It's possible that there's evidence that's not been available right now. But it seems unlikely. Most of the indicators suggest that money has been used to support army interests, but maybe not to support Musharraf's interests, and certainly not $700 million. There's very little evidence of that in particular.
This is Catherine Lanfer. This news just came across the wires that one of Pakistan's northwestern provinces just voted against Musharraf, that they're the second province to make this backing step in the impeachment. This latest news, does that add any more credence to this effort?
Well, it certainly adds credence to the effort to impeach him. I mean, that's very much underway. The question of whether it's impeachment for political reasons or impeachment because of actual corruption or mismanagement, that's sort of a separate issue. But yes, the Northwest Frontier Province Assembly, a provincial assembly, has voted in favor of Musharraf basically having to submit himself to a vote of confidence in the National Assembly. So this vote, like the vote before it, which was in the Punjab Assembly, are not really binding, but they basically express the sentiment of the provinces that Musharraf should stand up and essentially have to be re-voted into office as president. And of course, now that the assemblies, including the National Assembly, are held by the opposition, he would not be able to win such a vote, which would, by extension, lead to his dismissal.
Do you think there's any irony here that the leaders of the two opposition parties that have coalesced together have individually both been accused of corruption themselves, and that includes Benazir Bhutto's husband, who actually spent time in prison based on criminal charges of corruption?
Yeah, actually, if you look at the sweep of even relatively recent history, what you see is a pattern in which corruption is used as the primary reason for dismissing political leaders in Pakistan. That's been true for Nawaz Sharif, and that was true for Benazir Bhutto before him. In fact, when Benazir Bhutto was here in the United States prior to her return to Pakistan, she made exactly this point. She said that the charges of corruption against her and her husband were politically motivated, as are most charges of corruption against political leaders. And I think in many ways this is no different. Musharraf has become an extremely unpopular character in Pakistan, and so therefore a lot of different charges are coming out of the woodwork that, if he were a more popular character, would not be raised.
Now, what do you think the chances are, given Pervez Musharraf's relationship with the military, and not to mention the inter-services intelligence community, which is a very powerful factor in Pakistan politics, what do you think the chances are of him actually getting voted out and going quietly?
He appears at the moment like he's looking for a fight, that he will not go quietly. There is a lot of bluff and bluster going on right now on both sides, partially because he obviously would like to avoid this next step of an impeachment trial and will put up a strong face if there's any way that he can avoid it. And on the other side, there's a lot of bluster that if he doesn't go quickly or quietly, that things could get a whole lot worse for him. Obviously, both sides want to avoid a more destabilizing conflict. Certainly, the civilians would like to do whatever they can to keep the army out of this process. And at this point, the army looks like it's not interested in stepping in. But if Musharraf, who obviously was the head of the army for years, is humiliated or brought down in a way that the army feels hurts its own institutional interests, then it is still possible that the new head of the army would step in, and that would potentially bring an end to this latest period of democratic civilian government, which obviously from a U.S. perspective would be a bad thing, even though this has been an incredibly messy process so far.
So there's a lot of standing away and watching to see what happens. Daniel Markey, thank you.
Thank you.
Daniel Markey is a senior fellow from the Council on Foreign Relations, giving us his thoughts on what's happening and the developing story in Pakistan.
All right. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. I just want to remind you that we are always here on The Takeaway. You can catch up with us on Facebook, FriendFeed, Twitter.
And as you know, Catherine, we're always asking our listeners to join in the conversation, and someone did.
My sponsor in AA has helped me see the world differently and helped me throughout my life.
And so there you go. We were asking who inspired you, who has helped you in your life. And we were talking about Fannie M. Lewis from Cleveland, who passed away this week. And she certainly changed lives.
Some people says, as I don't vote, I am devastated.
He inspired a whole lot of folks.
All right. Tell us who inspired you. 877-8 MyTake, MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
And here's your takeaway for today, or our takeaway.
I can assure you that if a wedding ring drops in the sand at a beach volleyball event, I'm there first with a metal detector.
That's our own Ollie Williams of the BBC. He's there. He's our guy giving us an inside look into the Olympics, like American beach volleyball player Kerry Walsh losing her wedding ring.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
It's a record-breaking number of record breakers.
Michael Phelps, he's going to tie the greatest Olympic champions of all time and do it in world record fashion. Pearsall is going to back up his goal, and another world record. Here comes Lizak, another world record.
Oh, you know the rest. Another day at the Olympics, another broken swimming record. But is new technology at play here? Is it the swimmer or the swimsuit? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, August 12th. Catherine Lamper is in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Catherine.
Hey, good morning, Adora.
Also today, the Midwestern flooding in June may not have hit crops as hard as industry watchers had feared, so that could be good news. We talk about the placebo effect. Is it all in your head? And the latest crisis in the Republic of Georgia, including a talk with a Georgian ambassador to the UN. That's all coming up this hour, but first, these headlines. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has called for a halt to military action in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. But he also ordered Russian troops to stamp out Georgian resistance. He says Georgia must pull troops from the breakaway regions that started the conflict and pledged to stop fighting. There has been no formal response from Georgia. The Russian announcement comes as French President Nicolas Sarkozy heads to Moscow to mediate. In northwest Pakistan, a roadside bomb targeting an Air Force bus killed at least 12 people. Pakistani officials say an Al-Qaeda-linked militants are probably behind the attack. In late June, Pakistan stepped up military operations in the region.
Mexican authorities have established an anti-kidnapping squad in response to growing concern about the kidnap and murder of a prominent businessman's son. The squad will consist of 300 officers spread throughout Mexico. There have been thousands of kidnappings in Mexico in recent years.
Oil prices are at a three-month low to just around $114 a barrel in Asian trading this morning. The drop is attributed to a stronger dollar combined with lower demand from China.
In politics, John McCain is in Pennsylvania today before heading to New Jersey for a fundraiser. Barack Obama is on vacation, but his campaign has announced that he will reveal his pick for vice president via text message and email sometime before the Democratic National Convention starts Monday, August 25th. The Dow closed up just under 0.5% at 11,782. The S&P jumped a little over 0.5%, and it opened at 1305.
What are we talking about today?
Oh, Olympic records. How many of them will be made at this year's Games? Now, have you ever set a record? You can tell us what your record event is.
What would yours be?
Eating. In any category.
I think we'd probably tie for that one, yeah. For sure.
Well, and also we're going to be talking a little later about all of these broken swimming records. There are swimming officials who are very concerned. It's not only the suits and their new technology, but even the design of the pool.
Technology versus physical prowess.
Exactly. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning on this Tuesday, August 12th. Catherine Lamper is in for John Hockenberry today. Hi there, Catherine.
Hey.
And we're going to be moved right now and talk about what's happening in Russia. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev ordered a halt to military action in Georgia today after 5 days of air and land attacks that took Russian forces deep into the small Western, pro-Western allied nation. Medvedev said on national television that the military had punished Georgia enough for its attacks on South Ossetia. Georgia launched an offensive late Thursday to regain control over the separatist Georgian province of South Ossetia. And also some of the fighting has moved to the separatist province of Abkhazia, which also has close ties to Russia. Anne Bernard is following the story from Moscow for our partner, the New York Times, and she joins us now. Anne, many thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So what exactly did President Medvedev say today?
Well, President Medvedev said that he had made a decision to stop the operation to bring peace to South Ossetia. However, he left Russian forces plenty of leeway to continue fighting by saying that they were authorized to mop up any hotbeds of resistance. And his military staff said that forces would also conduct reconnaissance and other operations if needed. So, and that matches what we're hearing from the field. It's not clear that this actually means an end to fighting on the ground. We have correspondents in Gori, which is the transportation hub and military installation city about 45 minutes drive from Tbilisi.
In Georgia.
In Georgia, yes. Mm-hmm. Our correspondent there heard bombs falling about an hour before Medvedev's speech. There was heavy bombing there today. 5 people were killed in the central square. And in the west of the country, in Poti, a port city on the Black Sea, another correspondent of ours heard bombs falling about an hour after Medvedev's statement. So he also said that Georgian dock workers there had been approached by a column of about 10 Russian armored vehicles, those soldiers said they were looking for Georgian military. The situation in Poti was tense. Georgian police there said that they had not had any formal contact with the Russians, and they did not know exactly what was going to happen. There was not actual fighting on the ground there, but the situation still seems very fluid.
And so what do you make of this? The Russians keep saying one thing but seem to be doing another. A day or two ago they said they weren't moving into Georgia proper, but indeed it turns out they were. Today the president is calling for a halt in the violence, but the violence continues.
Well, Russia has always cast this operation as being aimed at protecting its peacekeepers in South Ossetia and in the other breakaway territory of Abkhazia in western Georgia. So they've always been reserving the right to carry out operations outside those territories if they believe that that will protect their peacekeepers inside those territories. Now, of course, the Georgian government believes that this is all just a cover for a larger plan to overthrow the Georgian government or occupy Georgia.
Now, and this is Catherine Lanfer. Just speaking of cover, we keep saying that President Medvedev has given these orders, but what about Putin?
Well, again, it's actually unclear who is making the decisions here, and that's one question that we want to clarify with the negotiators. Who is their partner in the Russian government? Because there are conflicting statements coming and ambiguous statements coming out of the government.
So you mean even with a diplomatic solution, we're not even sure who to be negotiating with?
That's right. I mean, we're going to hear more clarification soon when Medvedev gives a press conference after meeting with the negotiators.
And Anne, what do you understand is happening on the diplomatic front? I mean, we understand the French president Sarkozy is there now. Who else is involved, and has there been any substantive discussions that you're aware of?
Well, Bernard Kouchner is here, and Alexander Stubb, the head of the OSCE, has met with the Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov. He said that Lavrov told him that the statement really means that there's an end to military action if there's no retaliation from the Georgians. Mr. Stubb said there is always a gap between rhetoric and reality. But he does believe that hostilities are about to end.
So it sounds like a lot of confusion, and obviously a story that we will continue to watch for developments. Anne Bernard, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Anne Bernard reports for the New York Times, and she was coming to us from Moscow. She's right in the middle of it all. Catherine?
We're going to move from Moscow to the Midwest now, Adora. The floods that hit the Midwest in the June, you remember them, they raised more than water levels. Corn and soy prices soared as newspapers ran headlines warning of ruined crops. But this morning, we're going to be hearing two major reports that might have surprising good news. Crops are in, and the news could be good. We're joined now by Chad Hart, an agricultural economist at Iowa State University. And he is, just like us, waiting to hear those numbers. Chad, welcome to The Takeaway.
It's a pleasure to be here today.
I want to roll you back down memory lane. It wasn't that long ago, July 17th, you had a conversation with The Takeaway's John Hockenberry about the floods and their impact on the crops. Let's take a listen.
You've got the corn crop, you've got the soybean crop, and then you've got sort of various livestock crops that are dependent on those crops. Start with corn. What's the percentage loss at this point? Can you calculate?
Right now, early estimates show we got about 2% of what was planted, another 9 or 7% that we lost due to flooding. So we're out almost 10% of the expected corn crop here in Iowa.
And that's already starting to have a big impact on the price of corn in the commodities markets, right?
Yes, definitely.
All right. So we're talking 10% on corn alone. I mean, that sounded pretty bad.
Well, it was 10% in Iowa, and it was pretty bad at the time. What we've had since then, though, is almost ideal weather throughout the Midwest and the potential to replant some of that crop we lost to flooding.
So what does that say about these reports that are coming out today?
Well, at least right now, the best guesses are is that we're seeing an improvement over what we had last month. And a somewhat sizable improvement. Right now, I think early estimates say that USDA is going to come out with about 250 million more bushels of corn than they projected last month.
Chad, there must be a serious collective sigh of relief, because I recall there were lots of estimates from lots of corners who were thinking that this might be an historic, disastrous year for farmers in Iowa.
Well, this is definitely a good sigh of relief, but we're still not there yet. This crop is still in the fields today. We could still have some damage happen to it, but it looks better and better each day.
Yeah, I meant to say earlier, crop estimates are in, not crops. So what if the news is good today, what does that mean in terms of prices?
Well, we've already seen, actually, the market's getting prepared for this. Just like we've seen in crude oil with prices dropping there, we've seen the same thing for our corn and soybeans. We're down back to where we were before the flooding occurred right now. So if we get the crop, or if we get the crop estimates we're expecting today, I think the market's probably going to stay about where it is right now. It may actually decline just a little bit more.
I'm also wondering if the crop estimates are good, and it looks like we won't have these losses. You know, usually in the wake of a flood, we have a lot of discussion about floodplains, about how we should make changes in our farming policies in terms of how we treat the land. Does this put all of those arguments on the back burner again?
No. I mean, you're still seeing those conversations go on throughout this. I know here in the state of Iowa, we have had a task force going throughout the state looking at what sort of changes do we need to make to avoid this type of situation again with the flooding.
All right. And also, what does this do in terms of the global food market when we have an increase in the expectations?
Well, definitely it alleviates some pressure there for the world market, especially in corn. The U.S. represents about two-thirds of what's traded worldwide. So what happens to the U.S. crop happens to the world crop. So it is a big deal there.
All right. I want to thank you for joining us. And before I say goodbye forever, Chad, we are going to be talking to you a little later this morning when those reports come in.
Yes, we will.
All right. I want you to hang in there then.
All right.
Chad Hart. He's an agricultural economist at Iowa State University. How about that? Good news, Adora.
I know. We like good news on occasion around here.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't seem like we get to talk about that a whole lot. But no, I mean, I recall, and there was such heartache. We talked to some farmers at that time, and it looks like for some that things so far look pretty good.
I know. Well, we're going to hear more about that. Here at The Takeaway, I'm Catherine Landfer, in for John Hockenberry.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We've been asking today, who inspires you and how? Yukari in New York wrote on our website, she said, I find my inspiration through my friends at a winery in Japan. Coco Farm and Winery is staffed by mentally disabled adults who work in the vineyards all year long, harvesting grapes, working the crush, and helping with the bottling. I'm motivated to be a better person, she says, when I meet the students. Thanks so much for that story, Yukari, and we'd like to hear from you. Who makes you a better person? 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Join the conversation, and joining the conversation today is Catherine Lamper, who's in for John Hockenberry. Catherine?
Hey, thanks, Adora. You know, some of us watch the Olympics for the sports, but Jonah Lehrer, the Takeaway's science correspondent, he can't help it. He watches for the science. You might see great feats of athleticism and some really cool commercials. Jonah looks at the tube and thinks, huh, what about the placebo effect? He joins us from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio. Jonah, you geek.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. All right, so when you're looking at the Olympics, what brings your mind to the placebo effect? What are you talking about here?
Well, people talk a lot about doping, and one of the substances that seem to be, you know, one of the big doping trends right now is human growth hormone. The problem with human growth hormone, at least from the perspective of medicine, is that it doesn't seem to do very much for elite athletes. Most athletes say they take it to recover from injury, but most studies of human growth hormone show that it doesn't seem to help very much.
So why are people taking it?
Well, that I think is where you invoke the placebo effect. I think athletes are taking human growth hormone not because it gives them a real edge, but because it gives them an imaginary edge, which, because the brain is very good at self-deception, then gives them a real edge.
that makes me wonder then if there really is something physical happening in the brain.
Yes, there absolutely is with the placebo effect. I think one of the best studies comes from Tor Wager's lab at Columbia University, and he put students in a brain scanner, gave them electric shocks, and then gave them a hand moisturizer, which he told them was a very powerful pain-relieving cream. Sure enough, when he gave them this hand moisturizer, which they thought was a powerful pain-relieving cream, you could see a big difference in their brain. The prefrontal cortex actually shut down the insula, which is a part of the brain that perceives pain. So because these people expected to experience less pain, they actually did experience less pain. It really was the placebo effect at work.
Jonah, that's just wild.
Yeah, and you know, I imagine if you saw some of these athletes taking human growth hormone, and that's a drug that's very hard to test for, you'd probably see a similar thing, that the reason it helps them recover from injury is because they think it helps them recover from injury.
And yet at the same time, if they took it, they'd be disqualified from competition.
That's where it gets a little murky. The official policy of the IOC is that any substance that people think helps them cheat is actually cheating. So they seem to have the placebo effect built into their policy.
So even if I was taking a placebo pill and I was performing better because of it, because my intent was to cheat, I'd still be guilty of cheating, even though technically I didn't.
Those are what the rules suggest.
Huh.
Why don't these rules cover things like, diet, clothing, etc.?
Well, that's really where it becomes a slippery slope. I mean, athletes are taking HGH, they say, to recover from injury. So then do we ban painkillers? Do we ban Tylenol? Do we ban aspirin? At a certain point, people take drugs, and part of even the effect of aspirin comes from the placebo effect. Well, there have been studies showing that generic aspirin is less effective than brand name aspirin, not because it actually is less effective, but because people think it's less effective.
So then let's flip this on its head. What about the power of the mind for those athletes who are not taking anything?
Well, you know, they may be susceptible to not having the placebo effect. So they may be a little less self-confident. When it comes to the Olympics, self-confidence is a crucial edge. Thinking you're the best in the world, having that swagger really does give you a real edge.
I guess it didn't work for the French swimming team, though, in the relay race. They were talking a lot, but yet and still the American team, along with Michael Phelps, managed to pull it off.
Perhaps all that talk was a little self-compensation for their, you know, deep down insecurities. I think you saw when they tightened up in the last leg, I do think you saw that's a classic example of choking. Tightening up is one of those synonyms for choking.
No, it sounds like you've been watching a lot of Olympics coverage.
Yeah, I'm a pretty big sports fan, so it's been a lot of fun.
What does all of that, you know, when we watch these games, what does that do to our brain?
Well, it is, you know, I think a very interesting question for neuroscience is why people love to watch so much, why we love to watch sports. What is it about sports? You know, you're watching players play these, you know, strange games on television, and yet we're all riveted. And I think one of the interesting hypotheses out there right now is a set of cells called mirror neurons. These are a set of cells in your premotor cortex that light up when you watch someone smile or swim a 400 relay. They light up. These cells light up as if you were smiling, as if you were swimming that relay. They literally mirror the movements of people on television or in real life. So these cells have been used to explain all sorts of aspects of social cognition, but I think they also explain a lot about sports. When I'm watching the American swimmer relay, these mirror neurons think I'm swimming the relay. They really collapse that distinction between spectator and athlete.
So when you, for instance, when I'm watching men's gymnastics, which is so far from any skill set I have, that would explain why I'm so riveted?
I think so. And for me, I can't help but grimace during some of those routines when they do the splits. You know, I think my mirror neurons go a little crazy there. But I think mirror neurons do help us get involved in sports like curling. I found myself watching curling. I don't even know what curling is, and yet I couldn't turn off the television.
Hey, Jonah, I want to ask you to stick around because in just a few moments, we're going to be having a discussion, in fact, about whether new technology is helping to break all these swim records. So can you stick with us?
Please.
All right, Jonah Lehrer. He is the Takeaway Science Correspondent. And now we're going to turn, of course, to our news correspondent, Femi Okeh, who has the latest headlines.
Thanks very much, Catherine. Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Good morning. Some mixed messages out of Russia this morning. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has called for a halt to military operations. But he also said that Georgia must pull troops out of disputed regions and stop fighting. And he also ordered Russian troops to crush any Georgian resistance. There's been no response from Georgia yet to the Russian statement. French President Nicolas Sarkozy is on his way to meet Medvedev in Moscow later today to try and broker a European Union-backed truce. He will then travel to Georgia to meet President Mikhail Saakashvili. Oil prices have dropped to their lowest rate in 3 months. Analysts say that the lower demand from China and a stronger dollar combined to push oil prices down to $114.45
a barrel. Wow, 114? Imagine we were up to 147 just a little over a month ago.
We count it all the way up, and I feel that we should count it all the way down again.
Right, exactly.
That's more exciting. Coming up in my next newscast, the empty seats at the Olympics and how they're being filled.
I noticed that. Thanks, Femi. We'll look forward to it.
Yeah. See you later.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning on this August 12th, Tuesday. We are joined by Catherine Lampner, who is in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Catherine.
Hey, Adora.
And as you know, we've been talking about the passing of a Cleveland legend, Fannie M. Lewis. She was quite an inspiration to hundreds, if not thousands, of people in Cleveland and
she
the variety
of areas. She was a force
of
political
nature.
So we've
been asking, who inspires you?
Hi, my name is Annie Hartwell. I'm calling from Framingham, Massachusetts, and no doubt the people who influenced me and motivated me politically were my parents. From a very early age, we talked about what was going on in the world and locally at dinner time.
Thanks so much for that. We've gotten so many responses, so we want to know who inspires you, who makes you a better person, who spurred you to action, what did they do, and who are they? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Catherine?
Hey, I am in for John Hockenberry, as we said. Now, if you've noticed, world records are just tumbling down at this summer games at an astounding pace, especially in the water. Some swim officials are wondering if the new technology in both the suits and the pool is giving athletes an unfair advantage. Jerry Longman of the New York Times is going to join us to explain. Jerry, how can there be such a thing as too many world records broken?
Well, some people think that, you know, setting this many, I think there have been, like, last count, there's one set about every 3 minutes here, so I lost count at, I think, 8 or 9. But once, I mean, there's a sense by some people that, you know, that the records are falling so quickly that each record is being devalued and that, you know, technology is sort of unduly aiding human performance.
Well, in fact, we should remind everyone that you are calling in from Beijing. But it's been another day, so didn't we have another record broken this morning?
I think there was. I wasn't at swimming this morning, but I think you're right. I think there was. So it's probably up to 9 or 10 now.
What technology are we talking about that could make such a difference in the pool?
Well, first, it's the pool itself. These championship, international championship meets, the whole idea is the technology to dissipate waves that and to sort of dampen the turbulence in the water. So this Olympic pool is 3 meters deep, about 10 feet deep, and a lot of racing pools are 2 meters deep. And so the deeper the pool, the less turbulence you get, or theoretically, the less sort of turbulence you have, bouncing off the bottom of the pool. You've got plastic lane dividers that are designed to force water downward instead of outward so it won't splash across the lanes. You've got a 10-lane pool, so both outside lanes are empty, and that is also designed to sort of buffer the waves and draw them towards a gutter system instead of letting them ricochet back into the pool. And then the probably the most controversial innovation this year since February is that the Speedo company has put out a suit called the Laser Racer.
That's gotten a lot of news, yeah.
It's got a lot of attention. There have been more than four dozen world records set in long course and short course swimming pools with it. And it's designed to, it's kind of a compression garment, almost a corset-like garment. And some people, it takes some of the swimmers a half hour just to put it on. But it it provides you... you know, in a more streamlined position in the water. And some people, the Italian national coach calls it technological doping because there's some critics feel that it gives you added buoyancy in the water when that's not allowed under the international swimming rules. But I don't think enough testing has been done on that yet. So it's, you know, it's allowed into the pool. One of the issues is that not every swimmer would have access to the suit, and if you don't have access, obviously you won't swim as fast.
Well, in fact, doesn't that get to the point of it's whether you have the funds for all this technology that's going to determine what kind of an athlete you are?
Well, at least right now at this level, I think Speedo is making the suits available to everybody at the Olympic level. But you know, down the road, if you're a younger swimmer and you don't have access, I mean, if you're in a developing nation, you may not have access to that particular suit. Or if you have an endorsement contract with another company's suit that's not, you know, quite as fast a suit as this one, then you may be at a disadvantage. It's so the French coach is calling for a lot more debate on this, and we'll see where it goes from here. But you know, technology does always sort of win out here, so I would assume that these suits will even get, you know, faster. That the bioscience expert for the U.S. swimming teams thinks that, you know, there'll be suits down the road that actually allow your muscles to contract faster, which will allow your kicking ability to improve. So these things seldom go backwards.
You know, Jerry, I want to bring in Jonah Lehrer. He's our science correspondent, and he, in fact, has been looking at the placebo effect. Now, Jonah, after everything that Jerry has told us, how can just putting on one of these swimsuits, I would think that would make an athlete automatically think he's going to do better.
Yeah, but I think these new suits have the added benefit of actually being more effective. Plus, I'm sure they make you feel a lot more effective, too. I mean, they often look very, very sleek in the water.
Yeah, the swimmers actually say they feel like they're swimming downhill in these suits. So, you know, that probably makes up 100. I mean, we're talking about races that are won by hundreds or thousands of a second. So any little advantage can be dramatic in these kind of races.
All right. Well, Jerry, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and I hope we speak to you again there in Beijing.
Thanks a lot.
That's Jerry Longman. He is a sports reporter for the New York Times. We were also joined briefly there by Jonah Lehrer, our takeaway science correspondent. And now we veer over to our record-breaking Femi Okeh with the news.
Thank you very much, Catherine. 21 minutes to the hour. In Pakistan, an official says that military forces have killed a senior al-Qaeda member in clashes near the Afghan border. He was an Egyptian man. The September 11th commission called him a chief financial manager for al-Qaeda. Just hours ago, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev delivered a televised speech. In it, he said he's ending the military operations inside the Republic of Georgia. But he's calling on Georgian troops to leave the breakaway regions that sparked the ongoing dispute. Mexican authorities have formed a new squad to combat the growing problem of kidnapping. The capture and killing of a prominent businessman's son prompted officials to establish the 300-strong task force. Thousands of people have been kidnapped in Mexico in recent years. Now, the Olympic venues have been sold out for weeks, but none of the venues are completely full. So take, for instance, yesterday, only out of 18 venues, only two of them were 90% full to capacity. Now, corporate hosts, bad weather and people waiting for the finals, that's been attributed to why the attendance has been so low. But China's Olympic...
So people buy the tickets and then just are waiting for the final as opposed to going to the trials leading up?
They wait for the really exciting ones rather than the heats. But China has come up with a very novel way of filling the seats. They're using cheer squads. Now, these are people who actually fill out the seats, and they cheer for both sides.
Oh, which is great, no. That's not new. They got that from the Academy Awards.
But they're not cheering for both sides. They're just filling the seats while they go to the restroom.
Well, and you think this isn't just filling the seats?
Yeah, and they're all dressed in the same identical T-shirts, and they're adding to the atmosphere of the Olympics.
I see. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. And something caught our eye yesterday, nanotechnology, having to do with many things, but particularly the story this week is about scientists at the University of Berkeley who've developed materials which they say could create a kind of something like invisibility. And we're not talking about Harry Potter invisibility, as in his cloak. Joining us to explain on the phone is our pal, Jonah Lehrer, the Takeaway Science contributor, but also we're having Bruce Kramer join us, a senior advisor at the National Science Foundation. The foundation actually funded part of that research at the University of Berkeley. So, Bruce, what is nanomanufacturing?
Well, Doria, nanomanufacturing, I guess, is taking new technologies that are developed at a very, almost unbelievably tiny scale and figuring out ways to produce products at prices that consumers can buy them and use them and cost-effectively benefit from all this technology.
And what's an invisibility cloak in the way that the University of Berkeley scientists meant it?
Well, I mean, it's a fun thing to talk about, an invisibility cloak. And the truth is you would need materials like these to make such an invisibility cloak. But that's a very long-term goal here, I would think. And the actual short-term goal of the folks at Berkeley is to essentially to develop methods for making integrated circuits, which are much more precise, much finer scale, much denser, and at much lower cost using sort of normal light.
And Jonah, what's your take on this nanotechnology, this nanomanufacturing?
I really think it's an incredibly promising field. I mean, one of my favorite recent examples is Hewlett-Packard just announced that in the next couple of years they're starting to build what they call a central nervous system for the Earth, and that involves putting billions of nanorobots, nanosensors, all over the world, and these sensors will detect, you know, subtle tectonic shifts. They'll detect changes in ocean currents. They'll detect weather patterns. So this would all be fed into some big supercomputer, and then really give scientists an unparalleled sense of information about what's happening in the planet. So that's just one of the, I think, very exciting possibilities that are out there for the nano field.
And Bruce, we're talking about technology that's going to apply in so many. Jonah just talked about the climate and the world condition, but there's also reports about spheres, as they call them, golden spheres used to fight cancer?
That's true. There's a group at Rice University at a nanotechnology center that's funded by the NSF, and there's a very interesting property of these tiny spheres, and I want to make it clear again that these spheres are about 5 millionths of an inch in diameter, and they're actually made out of glass. They're coated with a very thin layer of gold, and they're injected into the bloodstream of a cancer patient. Or potentially, I want to make it clear, these are not applications that are here today, right? They're a few years off at least. But the cancer tissue, the blood vessels and cancer tissues are very leaky compared to normal blood vessels.
Mm-hmm.
And so these little spheres are carried by the blood. They leak into the tumor. They are lodged in the tumor. And they pass through the body otherwise in the healthy cells.
So certainly a lot of potential there. Just in terms of the size, you're talking about something that could fit in the hand of an ant. I love that example. Bruce Kramer, I'm sorry, we've got to go. We got to leave it there. But thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Bruce Kramer, Senior Advisor for Engineering at the National Science Foundation. And also on the line, Jonah Lehrer, our Takeaway Science contributor. Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. It is Tuesday, August 12th. Now, this morning we're talking about who inspires you. We would love to have you join in this conversation. Listen to this.
Hi, it's Gloria Mungie. I'm calling from Manhattan now. And I'm calling to let you know that my father inspired me as far as voting. He was the first one to be at the voting booths every morning in the projects in the Bronx, and almost to the day of his dying death.
Well, tell us who inspires you to. Call and leave a message at 877-MY-TAKE or send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now we're going to turn to Femi Okeh.
Thanks, Catherine. 12 minutes to the hour. Three Chinese police officers are dead after an attack at a checkpoint in western Xinjiang province today. Men armed with knives attacked the checkpoint, stabbing the officers to death. A fourth policeman was injured in the attack. A roadside bomb in Pakistan has killed as many as 14 people. The blast targeted a Pakistani Air Force truck. More than a dozen people were injured in the explosion near the northwestern city of Peshawar. A new congressional study says that around two-thirds of U.S. corporations managed to get out of paying any income taxes between 1998 and 2005. The report from the Government Accountability Office says that the same companies were doing trillions of dollars in sales during that time. And finally, they're making a comeback. It's the humpback whale. Gorgeous sound. An environmental group says that the humpback whale is on the road to recovery and is no longer in immediate danger of becoming extinct. The group says the population is up at least 60,000. Just four decades ago, the humpback whale was nearly hunted out of existence. Let's have one more listen. And that's your news.
Thank you, Femi.
There's been a number of developments this morning in the story involving the Republic of Georgia and Russia. This after President Bush has strongly condemned Russia's actions in Georgia, saying there were indications that it might be trying to depose President Saakashvili's government.
Russia has invaded a sovereign neighboring state and threatens a democratic government elected by its people. Such an action is unacceptable in the 21st century.
Now, President Saakashvili said he thought Mr. Bush's statement was strong, but he had expected concrete action from the United States and its allies. Russia has denied that it intends to overthrow the Georgian administration, and even this morning, the Russian president said that military action would halt in the region. Joining us now for his take on the story that's developing is Vasyl Sikharulidze, who is Georgia's ambassador to the United States. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Ambassador.
Thank you. Good morning.
What is your response to the Russian president's declaration this morning that Russian troops would halt the violence in the breakaway republics of South Ossetia and Abkhazia?
No, we highly appreciate the efforts of international community in order to get the ceasefire in place, but the situation still remains difficult. Russian invasion continues. They have overwhelming military force on the Georgian territory. They occupied several cities in Georgia. And their navy is blockading Georgian ports. Plus, their air force is flying missions, military missions, and they are targeting not only military infrastructure but civilian infrastructure. We have civilian casualties. During this day today, they bombed three villages around, even beyond the conflict zones. Three villages without any military infrastructure on it, and this military aggression continues.
Mr. Ambassador, are you saying that this morning the bombing continues after President Dmitry Medvedev said that he would halt violence?
Exactly this. I hope that that has not came down to his troops, and I hope that they will stop these bombings and this aggressive actions. But unfortunately, the reports which I'm receiving, which I received today from my capital, are not really saying that the military action stopped.
What would you like to see? What would the Georgian government like to see the United States do?
I think that the president was the president of the United States was very clear yesterday, and plus so did both major presidential candidates, Senator McCain and Senator Obama, also expressed their points of views on this particular situation. I think that now it's the time for very serious political efforts to, in order to stop this occupation of Georgia and to turn it into the turn the conflict resolution process into the international peaceful resolution way. So what we are seeking now is just to stop this military aggression and the military and the occupation of my country by Russian Federation.
Now, Mr. Ambassador, there are those analysts who say that the actions of your own president helped prompt this harsh Russian response.
I think that the rhetoric, some rhetorics which coming from Moscow are really ridiculous, and it's difficult even to comment. I remember that that reminds me sometimes the other aggressors, the excuses when they started to occupy their neighboring countries. I think that what we were demanding for years is that the genuine international force, peacekeeping force, and the genuine international peacekeeping format, which may resolve these disputes, these conflicts in a peaceful way, and we are still attached to this line, and we will still trying to trying to solve these conflicts in a peaceful way using international.
Mr. Ambassador, you would like the international community to send in peacekeeping forces. Are you talking about NATO? Are you talking about the European Union? Who would do that?
The important thing that the peacekeeping force should be genuinely international and impartial. That's the key here. I mean, that's the key to every conflict resolution. And plus, of course, it should be the real political format. I mean, the real political format for negotiations on place. That will ultimately, we believe, that solve these territorial disputes.
Has that request been made by the Georgian government?
It has been made 10 years from now, and the United States and the other European countries are working with us in this direction. The only problem to implement this was the Russia's position. They didn't want anybody to intervene politically or just to implement the peace.
Because essentially they were acting as peacekeepers in the two provinces.
That's now maybe we were saying this for years. Now probably it's clear for everybody that they are nothing but occupiers of these particular territories, and they cannot be peacekeepers.
And so today diplomatic efforts are underway with the French foreign minister in Moscow, as well as Nicolas Sarkozy, the French president. Can you give us a sense of what's being said in those discussions?
It's probably that it was this bilateral discussion between French president and Russian president. But we highly appreciate the efforts of French president and foreign minister Kushner. Foreign minister spent 2 days in Georgia, and he brought a ceasefire proposal to Georgia yesterday, and day before yesterday, which has been signed by President Saakashvili. And we hope that these efforts will bring at least ceasefire in place, and then we have to continue work towards the occupation of the country.
Mr. Ambassador, many thanks for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Vasil Sikharulitsa is Georgia's ambassador to the United States, and he was joining us from Washington.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry, and I want to remind you that we're always on The Takeaway. You can catch up with us on Facebook, FriendFeed, Twitter.
And on today's show, the latest from the conflict in Georgia, we just heard from the ambassador to the U.S. World records, are they really meant to be broken, we were asking, and how nanotechnology can make things, well, invisible.
You know, I thought it was very good of you to keep your eye on something that tiny. We also want to know who has inspired you in your life. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And you can go to our website, thetakeaway.org. And you can also, as Catherine just said, you can listen to our show online and weigh in at any time.
I'm Catherine Lanfer in for John Hogenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and you're listening to The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.